Hi, I'm Jill Haas, and I'm a writer, freelance writer, and a musician also, and just as a hobby, basically.
Mm-hmm. So tell me that story of that you wrote to me a little bit about, anyway, of like, and we can sort of break it down into stages, but maybe the first time you had an encounter with the music of Joni Mitchell.
My first encounter with Joni Mitchell's music came through the radio, and it was songs that were more commercial, and they were getting airplay, and I did not like her at all. So basically, whenever I heard something that was on of hers, I just would change the channel.
Why not?
I didn't like her voice. I didn't like the, you know, the ooh part, and I didn't like the commercial music, basically, and that's all I ever got to hear. At that point, I didn't own any albums, so all I heard was the songs that got airplay.
And where were you living then? What were you listening to? Was it AM radio, or can you tell me, like, that sort of environment?
I was living in Southern California, Newport Beach area, and I listened to FM radio, and mostly at that time I was listening to Led Zeppelin, Cream, Blind Faith, and also Neil Young, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, James Taylor, Cat Stevens, and also learning a lot of Led Zeppelin tunes. That was sort of what I was doing on musically at that point.
So this sounds like about 1971, 72,
exactly.
Thereabouts, right? Yeah. Okay, so the music that you were hearing from Joni Mitchell on FM radio was mostly the more familiar songs from her earlier albums before Cord and Spark, probably, right?
Yes, I would say like Big Yellow Taxi, I'm trying to think. What?
Chelsea Morning, Both Sides Now.
Both Sides Now, probably not Chelsea Morning. I'm trying to remember what kind of songs. But yes, definitely pre-Court and Spark. Maybe You Turn Me On, I'm a Radio. Not a whole lot of stuff was getting played on the stations that I was listening to because they were more rock and roll.
Yeah.
So, but the ones I heard, I did not like. So.
Gotcha. Yeah, and so then there's another chapter to the story. What, where does it go from there?
Well, I hung out with a group of friends, and we all brought our guitars to high school every day. And this is how I got introduced to some of the less popular Joni Mitchell songs. A friend of mine played a beautiful version of Little Green, yeah. She played Little Green and sang it beautifully. And I said, who's that? Who wrote that? And she told me who. And so I went to a garage sale and just happened to run into the album Blue. And it was like 10 cents. And I thought, well, you know, I might as well look into this. And I bought it, I played it, and I played it and kept playing it. And just the, you know, something happened, and suddenly I just became an amazing, you know, I just saw the amazing lyrics, the amazing music, the rhythms, just, you know, it takes a lot of playing to really understand everything that's going on in a Joni Mitchell album.
Mm-hmm. So when you got to explore that more completely, there were just, and I'm going to ask you to expand a little bit on that, I guess, about what was appealing to you. A lot of people talk about, you know, the confessional lyrics or something about how she would express the ambiguity of relationships. What was coming through for you?
For me, it was many, many things. One of them was that when I'd hear these lyrics, something would occur in my life, and the line would just pop up, and it would describe perfectly, in, you know, so much better than I ever could, what I was experiencing. Another thing was I was learning her songs on guitar and piano. So I was learning all these tunings, and I learned through that how complex her playing is, the rhythms, the chord structures. And so I gained an appreciation of both the music and how the lyrics basically spoke to my own life.
Was the fact that it was complex musically intriguing or off-putting for you as a budding musician?
Absolutely intriguing. It was, I had been playing other stuff that was difficult, but this was just very different. And the tunings, the rhythms, I think. A lot of people don't talk about her rhythmic sense in the guitar playing. And I found that just very challenging. And it was not at all off-putting. As a matter of fact, I stopped trying to play anything else. I just felt like that was the greatest challenge.
So what songs come to mind when you, if you were going to try to communicate something about that, like a song that would help people appreciate the complexity of it? Can you draw one out that might illustrate that?
Well, I think if you listen to, say, the rhythm in Cold Blue Steel and Sweet Fire, or Coyote, or another song would be that I find demonstrates a great rhythmic sense is Turbulent Indigo, one of her later tunes. Piano, I would say Paprika Plains, Ludwig's tune, and there's a third that I find intriguing, and I can't remember the name. But that just demonstrates her style on piano. And I play also a song called Down to You, which I find very complicated, chord changes, key changes, like every two measures we're in a different key. And so it's a very complex song, and was very fun to learn to play on piano just for that reason.
Because people don't talk a lot about her piano playing. They talk a lot about her tunings and her rhythmic guitar style. Can you add a little more depth to, how she uses the piano in a uniquely Joni way?
Well, I would say that her piano playing, people have told me, let me just sort of backtrack. People have told me that, her music is entirely lyric driven. There is no, that she's structureless. There's a very complex structure. And so you don't hear this chorus, chorus, bridge, repeat type of thing. It goes on. It's like jazz music. It goes on a theme and then returns back to that theme. And unless you listen carefully, you don't really see the structure. But there's a very, very complicated structure there.
And then, so you found this album, Blue, and you got totally inside that. And then are there other benchmarks in your kind of relationship with her as a listener and budding musician that you'd wanted to talk about?
Well, after Blue, I went back and got all the old music. And, basically each one is a different, entirely different experience. I picked up Mountain Dulcimer at that point and, through the older ones and also through Blue. The songs, they're always, these songs just keep coming back to me even in my current life, so it's kind of hard to talk about, any particular benchmark. I'll find that I didn't like one then, that I now appreciate and understand more what she's talking about, or my musicianship has improved enough that I understand more what's going on musically. then I went forward and got Court and Spark and liked the less commercial songs on that too, like Down to You. And I kept going at that point. And I basically followed her, pardon me, and listened to, you know, each album as they came out over and over and over again. And, you know, would learn what I could from those. And then at some point, I think there was a little bit of a shift in my love for her, what she was doing. And it was during the Larry Klein era where Night Ride Home, I think there were three albums during that period where she was doing something a little bit different. The music was more produced. I wasn't hearing. I like her when she's playing much more simply, when it's, you know, not quite as produced. I would take like an album like Hygera and listen to it. And at that time, I was living with a band and playing with this group out in a Majestic Canyon in California, which there was a house called The Castle. And rumor has it Timothy Leary used to live there, and so this whole band lived there. And I would make them listen to these records and just say, listen to this, listen to this. And they would just go, yeah, yeah, right, I hear it. Can you stop now? And I would just, you know, basically they'd just kick me out of the room. I did that with both Hygera and Don Juan's Reckless Daughter. And, you know, so the love was not shared by really anyone except some girlfriends, singer-songwriters that I knew. And so I would make people listen to this stuff. And then I think when Mingus came out, that was sort of my that was a hard one to digest. But I also realized, you know, I've been listening to jazz in Joni's work this whole time. I mean, her music has a jazz component. I mean, it's you know, the way it's structured. And so jazz was not all that, you know, didn't strike me as a surprise or foreign. I realized that I understood it. And so I actually fell in love with Mingus. And then I was...
So let me slow you down a little bit there. So it didn't seem like she wasn't necessarily testing you in a way that put you on the sidelines from being a Joni Mitchell fan at that time. Then it seemed like a logical progression to you.
Yes, and I was willing to embrace, you know, anything she was doing. At that point, I just figured, you know, whatever she's doing, if I listen to it carefully enough, I will find, you know, I will find the goods. And I would say I always have. And so I basically did not say, you know, I like only this period. I know a lot of people that say I stopped listening or buying albums. That I have every single one. And I love Turbulent Indigo. And I also, one of my favorites right now is that I actually was not a favorite before, but is Shadows and Light. And I have that in my car just playing around. You know, I can listen to this stuff over and over and over again.
Is that the live record?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a concert I actually missed. I had tickets for it, but wasn't able to go, and it breaks my heart. I did see her at the Pacific Amphitheater I think it was about in 82 in California. Mm-hmm. But, that is now my favorite, and I'll have moments. I've listened to that album many, many times, but I'll have moments now. Like I remember at the Joni Fest last year, I was after a very long night of playing and singing. I was getting up in the morning and trying to, you know, put my face together, and I was standing in front of the mirror, and suddenly the song "Sweet Bird" came to mind. And there's this line, you know, all these vain promises on beauty jars. Oh, somewhere with your wings on time, you must be laughing, up on your feathers laughing. And it spoke to me of growing older. I was looking at my haggard face in the bathroom mirror, and I was patching myself up with makeup, and suddenly that song popped into mind. And I had never really understood those lyrics until now, when I'm getting older and trying to patch myself up, I'm realizing, you know, the sweet bird of time and change is, you know, it's happening. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, one of those moments where I went, aha, an aha Joni moment.
Is Sweet Bird, what album is that on?
Sweet Bird is on, I think it's on the live Shadows and Light. It's also on, I think it's on Don Juan's also.
I'll check.
Don Juan's Reckless Daughter. You know, just a song I never paid a whole lot of attention to. And then suddenly, I know all the lyrics to a lot of these songs, so they just pop into my head at moments where they become relevant based on whatever it is I'm doing. So that's been one of the gifts of Joni Mitchell. She finds a way to say beautifully what I'm experiencing.
And you've described a couple of times how her music seems to reward repeated listening. And I know you've said a couple of things about that, but part of what I do is, you know, pick up themes and ask for a little bit more background on that. So tell me more about the ways that Joni Mitchell's music continues to reward repeated listening.
I can listen to Joni Mitchell's records over and over without ever feeling like I have gotten everything from it. There's always something new to discover, whether it's musically or something in the lyrics as I grow older that becomes more relevant. And that means any of the albums. I can go back and listen to older ones, and I tend to get fixated on one at a time and listen to it just continuously. And then I'll think of a song off another one, and that will become my new favorite. And so that becomes, you know, the one that's in my car CD player 24/7. You know, it could be Blue for a month, and it could be, you know, right now it's Shadows and Light for I don't know how long I've been doing that one. And really, nothing's off limits. Even the ones that I thought I liked the least during that, you know, Night Ride Home period, even those I can go back and listen to and find things and get something out of them and find new appreciation for songs that I might have brushed off in the past. I never get tired of it, and she's really the only artist I can say that about.
Tell me your impressions of her excursion into the orchestrated background, where she did some standards and then she recast a lot of her older tunes, because I haven't had very many people talk about that. How did that strike you, and what thoughts did you have when you were encountering that?
I liked when she did the standards. A lot of those songs I'm familiar with, and I liked her arrangements. I thought, you know, the musicians were great. It was also something I could share, like, with my dad, and he really enjoyed that. And, you know, I'm always trying to talk people into liking Joni Mitchell, so, you know, that was an easy one for him. The one where she did her own music, I also liked, because there was a sort of a poignancy that came through her doing her older songs with this orchestration. And I think the orchestration also brought out the fact that the music is rich. You know, if you can get an orchestra to be playing these supposedly simple songs, you realize that there's a lot to work with in any song she does. There's a lot to work with.
Yeah, I've heard her say that one reason she was interested in doing that was to sort of cement the timelessness of some of the songs that she felt, you know, really were songs that she wanted people to be playing for a long time.
So she may have, when she was doing the album of her own music with the orchestra, she may have been considering making that almost, in a sense, a classic, you know, trying to create a classic piece instead of it being a folk music song or, you know, those little tags that she dislikes so much. And so showing that, you know, yes, these songs are more than little folk music tunes, you know, chick singer, you know, with a guitar kind of thing, and that they have the musical potential. I think she was trying to show that by, you know, having this orchestrated.
Yeah, and would you take a crack at describing what goes on at Joni Fest? Like, what's that scene about, and, you know, who's there, and what feelings emerge from that?
Well, Joni Fest is a new thing for me. I went the first time this last, what was it, in fall?
March.
Yeah. And it was an amazing experience from the time I walked in. All the part before and after was hell, the traveling and all. I just have a nightmare story about that, but that's for later. From the moment I walked in, I mean, that's one thing we all have in common, a love for Joni's music. Some of these people have been in this forever and ever, and for me, being brand new, it was all eye-opening, you know.
Could you refer to, like, numbers, like you're walking in and there's, like, I mean, are we talking about 40, 50, 30, 20, what is it?
At that Joni Fest, my guess would be, I don't know, 40-ish? I did not have a moment to count.
Yeah, but just to sort of...
Yeah, I would say about 40 people or so. Possibly more. People came for parts of it, you know, so there were comings and goings, different nights. But the activities are basically, you know, during the day you might be able to see some type of video that no one's ever seen before, or hear some music that is not out for public release. So you get exposed to just some special things that members have been able, through their connections with Joni Mitchell or people around Joni Mitchell, that they've been able to get access to. The evenings start with a fairly formal program of performances, and it's generally geared toward people performing Joni Mitchell tunes. During the day, people are rehearsing, they're getting ready for their moment of fame, you know, usually three songs per group, and that's every evening they do that. There have been some people have done other musicians' tunes, or their own even, but for the most part it's Joni's music. I got there, and I had signed up to play, and I was so intimidated by the quality of the musicians that I canceled my spot. I just felt like, I'm not ready for this. You know, I have newly kind of started playing again, and I just felt like I didn't have my chops. So my favorite part was post-show, where we do something called the song circle. And everyone gets in a circle, whoever wants to stay up late that night, with their instruments, and people will throw out a song like, hey, how about, you know, A Case of You, or does someone know Frey Sings the Blues? And there's always somebody that they call the human jukebox who can play everything. You know, just, oh, let me have a minute, we'll figure it out, and they've got it. So the group will maybe one person will sing the melody and other people will do harmonies, and it's a lot looser, you know, and we're not recording, or that part's not mic'd, we're just in a circle. And sometimes it, you know, gets kind of nuts. We're up till 3-4 o'clock in the morning, and we might be, you know, starting to try some screaming Led Zeppelin songs. You never know. But that was my favorite part. So I basically stayed for that every night, and just had to sleep late.
So as you walk away from that, though, for the first time, you know, what is there a way to articulate what is added to your appreciation experience with Joni Mitchell's music from that sharing?
Well, most definitely, from that experience, I would say I got exposed to a lot of things I've never heard before. I also realized that you know, there were some songs of hers that I just thought, you know, no one can play that, you know, and I didn't attempt it. Like "Furry Sings the Blues" is one I'm working on now, and I found the tuning on the website. I would say it just made me realize, first of all, that people can play these tunes. You don't have to be Joni. And also, just I got exposed to so many just unusual recordings, things like heard. People told me about things that were on YouTube, songs like "Trouble Man," that where she's playing with Herbie Hancock, "Summertime." I got some recordings I'd never heard of before, and that people had done some mastering work on, some things that they feel weren't recorded very carefully, weren't put on CD very carefully, mm-hmm. And so, you know. Also, that there were other people out there like me is a great feeling, you know. I have always felt like the biggest, you know, I'm kind of a freak because I like her this much, and to meet a group of people that like her that much also was just an astounding feeling. It's like you're bonded by that. You've never met the person, never seen the person before, but you're bonded by basically the love of Joni and her music. And there are some, you know, some people are critics of certain things, so it's not all Joni Love Fest, you know. There's some criticism that goes on in discussion, and, you know, some heated arguments about things. But it's just a great place to be where you can talk about things and people know what you're talking about.
Are there common denominators about people who really adore Joni's music or that intimate with it? Characteristics, psychographics?
And Joni fans, I would say, have what they would have in common, I would say, is probably, first of all, a love for the lyric, for her writing. I think that's initially kind of what brings people in. There are long-term Joni fans that are, you know, in their 60s. There were also people there that were 19. So it's a broad range of folks that have somehow discovered her and become, you know, one of the gals is, I think, 19 or 20. She talks about, you know, making converts among her friends of her age. And she's as crazy about Joni Mitchell as we are. I would say that, you know, a lot of people are kind of artistic, sensitive, if you're kind of categorizing it in a broader way. Some folks are into, you know, the more technical aspects of, you know, being kind of a librarian and chronicling and that kind of thing. But there's a large group of people that I would say are, you know, they identify as artists with her, mm-hmm. or writers, or, you know, something along those lines. And basically, I'm just guessing, but I would say more introspective people who are willing to spend some time with the lyrics and also who can appreciate the complexities of the music.
So when you say that there are 19-year-olds who are drawn to Joni's music, it makes me think about if there's a way to talk about the what she does so well that is timeless in nature. I mean, certain, as we like celebrate the summer of love, you know, there's certain songs that are just like locked in 1967, and they feel like hippie anthems to 19-year-olds today. But if a 19-year-old woman is listening to Joni, she's drawing something from that time or that message that seems more timeless. What, play with that a little bit in terms of, you know, if a 19-year-old can listen to something that Joni wrote 35 years ago, you know, what's going on there?
I would say that a 19-year-old who has become a Joni fan would probably be someone that is a musician themselves, probably a songwriter. And something about Joni Mitchell's songwriting, being a songwriter yourself, I think for those people it soaks in. You know, they understand. They hear the excellent songwriting. And I think that I had a friend actually who was, I think I was about 30 and he was 20, and I gave him Blue just because I pushed that on everybody. And I thought, oh, no way is he going to like this at all. And he just fell in love with it. Just fell in love with it. And he was an art student. He was learning to play guitar. And something about the writing, he's also, you know, a sensitive guy. And the writing just struck him. And I was really shocked that he would like it. Some of the folks that are 19 and 20 and all that are very much into alternative music. And I would say that would have been the case for me when I was that age also. I didn't really like commercial music. I tended to prefer stuff that didn't get airplay, and a lot, and I still do. Like, I listen to local, you know, Seattle bands and indie music, basically. If I listen to anything but Joni, it's usually that or hard jazz. So I think it would be that she would appeal to the indie, the group that likes indie music, and like the young gal at Joni Fest was definitely from that group and played that kind of music and wrote that kind of music. And so Joni's becoming sort of the alternative, you know, she's sort of fitting into this alternative groove for the young people.
Yeah. So it sort of suggests that whatever era comes along, that there's something about how she writes and constructs things that competes or stands up well with contemporary styles.
I think it competes with a certain kind of contemporary style. Definitely not the Beyoncé, you know, pop music of the day. But I would say the independent folks, you know, the small label people, alternative music, because they generally write more thoughtful songs. They generally are not just going after this big pop flash. And she appeals to people that are looking for more thoughtful music.
Well, now it sounds like we're backstage at Woodstock, yeah. So I think maybe that's a good place to stop. Was there anything else that you know, really came here wanting to say? Because we could find a quieter spot, maybe, but...
Not necessarily. I really appreciate this interview, and I think I've talked my little fool head off, so I'm fine.
Jill, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.